Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. A grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley. Supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker. A Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Florida's slugfest over workers' compensation isn't only limited to the issue of skyrocketing rates for employers.
No worker should be forced to abandon the doctors and other care providers they know and who know them just so an insurance company can save money.
Also tonight, a bill to set up more trauma centers in the state has some doctors worried it could destroy the quality of care patients get.
You can bill for trauma care, and so many hospitals think that there's money in it, but if you truly want to be a quality trauma center, it takes a tremendous amount of money.
We'll also get a medical marijuana update, go inside the hyper-partisan divide in the world of cable news, and discover which of Florida's counties is the only one to have an appointed sheriff. I'm Tom Flanagan. On the second day of week 5 of the Florida legislative session, this is Capitol Report. Lawmakers are trying to overhaul Florida's beleaguered workers' compensation system. But as Jim Ash reports, unions, legal experts, and employer groups aren't happy.
Senate leaders have a knack for turning to Republican Senator Rob Bradley when it comes to tackling complex and controversial issues. So when businesses were hit in December with a 14.5% increase in workers' comp rates, the Fleming Island attorney was a natural go-to guy. But it's clear from the powerful opponents who lined up against his bill that Bradley will need every ounce of his diplomatic skills. Here's Senator Anna Terry Flores, who chairs the Banking and Insurance Committee.
Jim McConaughey with Associated Industries of Florida, they are waving against the bill. Tom Stahl with Florida United Business Association is waving against the bill. Tim Nungesser with National Federation of Independent Business, they are waving against the bill. Carolyn Johnson with the Florida Chamber of Commerce, they are waving against the bill.
The list goes on to include almost every major business and employer group in Florida. When he learned that even the Florida Poultry Federation is against him, Bradley couldn't resist.
Well, you know, I really thought I had the Poultry Association on lockdown.
The rate increase is tied directly to Supreme Court decisions that struck down key provisions of 13-year-old business-friendly reforms demanded by then-Governor Jeb Bush. Business groups tie most of the rate increase to the loss of a cap on attorney fees, a decision known as Castellanos. Business groups want injured workers to pay their own attorney fees. Bradley's bill merely sets a $250 an hour maximum rate. He says the court left lawmakers no choice.
I think Castellanos, whether you agree with the decision or not, set forth some pretty clear guide rails. Any bill that is produced out of the Senate is going to respect those guide rails.
Unions are also against the bill. Bradley is proposing to increase payments for something called temporary complete disability from 140 weeks to 260 weeks. But AFL-CIO's Rich Templin says Bradley's bill doesn't go far enough to protect injured workers.
No worker should be forced to abandon the doctors and other care providers they know and who know them just so an insurance company can save money.
Bradley promised the bill is still a work in progress and that he would continue negotiating with all the stakeholders. His proposal would also change the rate-setting process, giving insurance companies more leeway to compete on prices. The National Council on Compensation Insurance studied Bradley's proposal and determined it would decrease rates by 3% and save $109 million. Bradley insists he's not trying to favor one side or the other. Bradley is also running a second bill that would shield the names of people who file workers' comp claims from public records laws. Business groups support the idea because it could make it harder for attorneys to recruit clients for lawsuits.
Attorneys that have pride in our profession, all right, bristle at the idea of members of our profession reaching out and sending mail to people who've been injured, trying to get them to sign up.
Bradley's bills passed the committee. But at the halfway point of the session, when most energy turns to budget negotiations, it's not clear if there'll be enough time to resolve differences with a competing House proposal. Last month, Florida Chamber of Commerce Executive Vice President David Hart told Tallahassee business leaders that workers' comp was the biggest issue of the session. He wasn't optimistic lawmakers could get the job done on time.
I've been involved in probably every workers' comp battle in the legislature for, you know, approaching 25 or 30 years. And sadly, our legislature's never been able to do a major workers' comp reform if it wasn't done in a special session.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Jim Ash.
Panama City Representative Jay Trumbull's legislation makes it easier to set up more trauma centers in the state. But hospitals say it will destroy the quality of care patients get. And as Sarah Mueller reports, doctors took to the Capitol to oppose the measure.
Trauma surgeon Michael Cheatham picked up the phone shortly after 2 a.m., June 12th of last year. There was a mass shooting at the Pulse nightclub just a few blocks from the Orlando Regional Medical Center. He hurried to the hospital.
You know, my initial thought was, this was just unreal. I drive by the Pulse nightclub to and from work every day. And to think that the worst mass shooting in U.S. history occurred three blocks from our hospital, it still is very surreal.
49 people died. The Orlando Regional Medical Center treated 35 people, many with multiple gunshot wounds. The hospital is a level one trauma center. That means it has a team of medical providers experienced in treating critically injured patients. Trauma surgeon Michael Cheatham says the hospital called in more than 400 staffers to tend to Pulse victims. He says legacy trauma centers like Orlando Regional have the resources and training that other hospitals who want to open trauma centers don't. And allowing more to open than is strictly needed will decrease patient volume and thus decrease doctors' skills.
You can bill for trauma care, and so many hospitals think that there's money in it, but if you truly want to be a quality trauma center, it takes a tremendous amount of money, and that would exceed what many hospitals are able to do. They can't invest that kind of money.
The Florida Department of Health oversees the state's 19 designated trauma service areas and caps the number of centers at 44. The health department allows new trauma centers based on population and need. The state has faced several legal challenges trying to create more new trauma centers. Representative Jay Trumbull says the state has spent $900,000 on lawyers related to trauma center rules, and he wants to ease those regulations.
The amount of litigation is outrageous. Just this last week, there was a hospital who was applying to be a level two trauma center, which is JFK Medical Center. And there are two other level one trauma centers that have now filed suit against the Department of Health.
Trumbull's legislation removes the cap and allows a new trauma center to operate for 5 years without evaluating the quality of care. It also does away with the designated trauma areas. A judge ruled earlier this year that the state wrongly let Orange Park Medical Center open a trauma center. Hospitals who want to open more such centers argue they'll be able to provide quicker access to life-saving care and more competition. Attorney Steve Menton with the Hospital Corporation of America says new trauma centers have improved access.
And in each of the cases in which I have been involved, there have been allegations every time about the parade of horribles that's going to happen when new trauma centers are opened. In fact, what has occurred is that new resources are brought into the state, access is enhanced, and the decline that has been projected has not occurred at the existing trauma centers.
HCA, formerly run by current Governor Rick Scott, wants to open more trauma centers. Scott has also called for removing the cap. But in 2014, the company was blasted for charging patients more than all other trauma centers in the state. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sarah Mueller.
Still to come on Capitol Report, state senators are moving forward with brand new medical marijuana legislation, but the major elements are anything but certain.
This is obviously number of licenses issue, which perhaps y'all have heard about.
The rise of hyper-partisanship continues to impact the way news is covered, especially on cable news channels.
We are in an era where everybody sees everything and where you can commodify and monetize things that are now parts of the news.
And we'll hear the latest on the Dozier School for Boys, the North Florida Reform School with a troubled past.
I would rather go back to the jungles of Vietnam. I would rather go back into battle than to spend a day at Mariana.
Support for Capital Report is provided by the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. Abletrust.org.
The ball finally appears to be rolling for medical marijuana in the Florida legislature. After tacking on a handful of amendments, Nick Evans reports legislation is advancing in the state Senate.
It seems broad support for the Medical Marijuana Initiative Amendment 2 is a two-edged sword. Nearly everyone agrees on medical cannabis in principle. They just have different principles. That's why Monday night Fleming Island Republican Senator Rob Bradley found himself wading through 14 different amendments.
Madam Chairman, members, this adds legislative intent language. And it's
thank you,
language.
Madam Chairman.
This amendment incorporates the medical marijuana testing
thank
language.
Thank you.
This language requires the concurrence of a second physician when certifying the use of marijuana for a person under the age of 18. This is language that actually moves us closer to the House position. This is language borrowed from the House.
Whether it was the tracking system, testing, or patients visiting from out of state, most of the proposals were Bradley's own. But nearly all of them were attempts to address concerns voiced by fellow lawmakers. The biggest one being, who gets to grow and sell the drug?
This is obviously the number of licenses issue, which perhaps y'all have heard about.
Bradley proposed and the panel adopted an amendment making significant changes to the benchmarks for adding new growers, now referred to as medical marijuana treatment centers, or MMTCs.
This amendment requires the DOH to register 5 additional MMTCs by October 3rd, 2017, including one applicant that is a member of the Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Association. It requires the DOH to add 4 new MMTCs within 6 months after the registration of each instance of 75,000 more patients to the Compassionate Use Registry.
Under the original version of Bradley's bill, growers would be added incrementally once the pool of patients reached 250,000. With the amendment, there could be as many as 17 additional license holders by the time it's that large. And Committee Chair Dana Young wants to expand the field even further. The Tampa Republican suggests authorizing 2 nurseries challenging the health department's decision not to give them permits in the first wave of licenses.
In the interest of saving taxpayer dollars on fighting these cases, and in the interest of fairness, we would go ahead and register these 2 MMTCs and would allow them to start with the ones who have gone through in good faith to become eligible, and that is the amendment.
But Fort Myers Republican Senator Elizabeth Beniquisto is uncomfortable with any new growers, and she spoke out against Young's proposal.
I believe that if they are, their challenges have merit, they will be successful, and they will be purveyors of this fine product in the future. But I can't support the amendment today.
Young's amendment eventually failed. But with Monday's hearing, it appears senators are coalescing around Bradley's amalgam of different proposals. That said, there's still a lot of daylight between the House and Senate measures. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
In the Trump era, cable news networks are experiencing a ratings boom. Joseph Zobias Roig reports on the blurring distinction between news and spectacle and politics covered as sport.
Kathy Aru regularly spars with commentators and hosts alike as a self-described, quote, liberal analyst on cable news. Her perspectives can trigger spirited debates on a network long known for towing a conservative line. Here she is on Fox.
Historically, we know Democrats are much better at the debt, are much better at GDP.
Did you take a look at the last 8 years?
On air, Aru often finds herself under siege for her views. But she says journalists should be prepared to debate issues as if they are black and white on TV.
There doesn't seem to have a gray area. And it's our job as journalists to present the facts
and have people decide for themselves. And that's what the New York Times and the Washington Post does beautifully. But for TV, you have an entertainment factor to it. And if you're a journalist that goes on TV, you have to understand that gray is sometimes confusing.
It's a hallmark of cable news. The on-air brawls over controversial issues like immigration and the economy, which some research suggests may further polarize opinions. For many years, the effects of cable news on the broader political discourse has stirred debate.
Well, obviously the viewers who are watching it like it, or they would turn it off.
Kelly McBride is the vice president of the Poynter Institute, a nonprofit journalism school in St. Petersburg. She says TV dumbs down the political conversation more often than not in search of higher ratings, leaving journalists at risk of oversimplifying complex events and policies on air.
That is absolutely what a lot of the television shows, not all of them, but what a lot of the television shows are looking for. Occasionally, I get asked to come on and debate issues around the media and politics. And I'm not, you have to be pretty well prepared as a journalist to go on those shows and not get sucked into oversimplifying and overstating your position.
Recent data shows viewership for the three network evening newscasts are down, while cable networks are experiencing a surge in ratings. MSNBC has overtaken CNN to become the second highest rated network in primetime, behind only Fox News. According to Republican political strategist and media consultant Rick Wilson, the volatile political era ushered in by the Trump administration is accelerating changes in the media landscape.
MSN and CNN are both trying to find a sort of different model where you end up with panels that are roughly more balanced, ironically, than Fox. I mean, Fox has become a one-note cheerleading section for Donald Trump.
Fox News has long been criticized for the right-wing slant of its programming. However, it generates billions of dollars in revenue each year for its parent company, 21st Century Fox. Today, the network accounts for a growing share of its parent company's profits, according to the New York Times. Fox News pins its success on hosts like Bill O'Reilly and Sean Hannity, both of whom reach millions of viewers each night with a blend of news and fiery conservative commentary. Veteran news anchor Ted Koppel recently told Hannity he is, quote, bad for America.
We have to give some credit to the American people that they're somewhat intelligent and that they know the difference between an opinion show and a news show.
Yeah.
You're cynical. Look at that. Yeah.
I am cynical because,
You think we're bad for America? You think I'm bad for America?
Yeah.
At times, it can feel that America's political divide is wider than it's ever been. But Wilson says there is nothing new about this moment. He says technology is making the access of and profit from information easier than ever before.
We're not in an era where the nastiness of politics is any greater or lesser than it's ever been. But we are in an era where everybody sees everything and where you can commodify and monetize things that are now parts of the news.
He may have a point. In 1968, ABC News is ranked last in network ratings. So to increase viewership during the presidential nominating conventions, ABC hired intellectuals Gore Vidal and William F. Buckley Jr. to debate politics. Buckley was a conservative and Vidal a liberal. The heated debates were a rating sensation, and they resulted in one of the most memorable exchanges TV had seen up to then.
As far as I'm concerned, the only sort of pro or crypto Nazi I can think of is yourself. Failing that,
Let's stop calling names.
Trump's rise to power has brought unique challenges to a television world where the border between news and spectacle is no longer clear. McBride says that while cable news networks can be much better about covering current events, the profit motive will likely loom large.
Well, I think they could choose a wider range of topics. I think that they could look to more diverse experts, and I think that they could create more nuanced conversations.
But McBride is quick to point out that isn't necessarily what ratings show audiences are after. She says cable news is a business after all. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Joseph Zeballos-Roich.
Florida lawmakers are pressing pause on a bill that would pave the way for an elected sheriff in Miami-Dade County. The plan's forcing legislators to choose between empowering voters or stepping on the toes of local governments. Kate Payne reports.
Miami-Dade is the only county in the state to not have an elected sheriff. The local government restructured the office in the 1960s, following reports of corruption. Now Miami Republican Senator Frank Artiles is using the same argument to bring back an elected sheriff.
So I think that a consolidation of power is corruption, and therefore I believe that its sheriffs should be elected, should have their own budgets, and be constitutional officers. And that is specifically why I'm doing this.
Artiles wants to draft a constitutional amendment, which would go on the ballot for statewide approval. The issue is forcing lawmakers to weigh the merits of home rule against democratically elected officials. Jess McCarty is a lobbyist for Miami-Dade, and he's concerned about putting the county's future in the hands of voters from Pensacola to Key West.
The voters of Miami-Dade County could vote against this, and the rest of the state could impose it on the voters of Miami-Dade County.
Miami-Dade is at the center of the issue, but the change would affect Volusia County as well. Sheriff Mike Chitwood is elected, but he can't act without the approval of local government.
Any issue that I want to put in place, community policing, for example, those issues have to be vetted before the county manager before I could put them in place.
Walton County Sheriff Mike Atkinson says the office should be accountable to voters, not bureaucrats.
The office of sheriff is essentially the only office, the only level of law enforcement in this country in which the local people have a say. They get to determine the tempo and tenor of how their office is conducted, how it's managed.
The Florida Constitution protects the rights of municipalities to govern themselves. For Fort Lauderdale Democratic Senator Perry Thurston, that begs the question, why should his county get involved?
So because you all don't have an elected, because I'm happy with my county where we do things, and I'm saying because of your situation, Broward County is brought into the fray here?
Laura Humans with the Florida Association of Counties has similar concerns.
We oppose any change to this provision. We're just philosophically in favor of home rule. We believe that the citizens of Miami-Dade County and the citizens of Volusia County put this in place. They had a reason for it, and there is a sufficient opportunity for them to change it.
There are ways for voters to amend their county charters, but Miami-Dade and Volusia aren't pulling those levers right now. Hialeah Republican Senator Rene Garcia has sat on a charter review commission in the past and says it's an uphill battle.
Sometimes I see it very difficult for us in Miami-Dade County to try to get issues on the ballot. It's just very arduous, and sometimes it just doesn't come to fruition.
Hence the statewide constitutional amendment. But apparently not enough lawmakers think that's the right way forward. The Senate Judiciary Committee temporarily postponed the bill Tuesday. That implies the plan doesn't have the votes it needs. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Kate Payne.
You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, the former wards of the now-closed Dozier School for Boys are one step closer to receiving a formal apology from the state of Florida. As Sasha Cordner reports, that's the Florida Panhandle School where alleged abuse occurred for several decades.
Retired Army Ranger Captain Bryant Middleton, now a decorated Florida veteran, was just a kid when he went to the Dozier School for Boys in the 1950s.
I've seen a lot of horror in my lifetime. I have. The battles of Dozier, though, are the ones that harmed me the worst, destroyed my life.
Over the years, many men have come forward talking about the sexual and physical abuse they suffered at the school, and Brian says he's no different. Sent to Dozier for being, quote, incorrigible, he says he received brutal beatings at a building nicknamed the White House for infractions, like eating blackberries and not pronouncing a teacher's name right. Middleton says the most severe beating occurred when he and another boy decided to run away because they were so scared.
Mr. Hatton, Mr. Tidwell, and the superintendent, Mr. Dozier, took the two of us down to the White House, and I was the first to be beaten. I lost count at 56. I passed out. I awoke in the other room, laying on the bed with a bloody nightgown and blood running down my leg as a child.
Andy says he was also sexually abused.
Once by a medical doctor, another by a gentleman who claimed to be a child psychologist.
And many other survivors say other boys fared worse because they died due to the abuse and were laid in unmarked graves. That's why Middleton says as his wounds continue to heal, he's grateful Florida lawmakers are considering making a formal apology to the Dozier wards. Stories like his are why Florida House Speaker Richard Corcoran is making this one of his priorities.
I got with General Bondi, and there's still one of the guards who tortured these children is still alive. And we went through every machination to try to figure out how we could still prosecute and bring justice. And we'll still work at it. We're not going to give up yet.
For now, a bill formally apologizing to the former Dozier wards unanimously passed its first Senate committee Monday. It's by St. Petersburg Democratic Senator Daryl Rouson.
It, one, expresses regrets for a shameful past and a shameful history. Secondly, it sincerely apologizes on behalf of the legislature. And lastly, it declares a commitment to make sure that these atrocities, these tragedies, never happen again.
Meanwhile, the House bill is slated to get its first hearing Thursday in the House Judiciary Committee. It's chaired by Palm Harbor Republican Representative Chris Sprouse. He says it includes creating Dozier memorials as well as a reburial effort of the unclaimed remains of boys on Earth on the property a few years ago by University of South Florida researchers.
The first is to reinter the bodies of the young men in 1914 who were lost in the dormitory fire, to reinter those bodies at Boot Hill Cemetery in Marianna. The second is to reinter the unclaimed remains of the Dozier men who are currently in the care and custody of the University of South Florida. And the third is to have two memorials, one in Marianna and one in the state capitol.
He says a lot of what's included in the bill comes from recommendations by the Dozier Task Force created by the state legislature last year. The House bill also includes language to name a USF Forensic Center after one of the Dozier victims. Forensic investigating helped USF researchers find the Dozier remains. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Cordner.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, Sarah Mueller, Kate Payne, and Joseph Zabaios Roy. We also thank our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report, and join us again each weeknight at this time throughout the 2017 Florida lawmaking session for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: a grant from the law firm of Searcy, Denny, Scarola, Barnhart, and Shipley, supporting public radio and taking time to care. On the web at searcylaw.com. Lewis, Longman, and Walker, a Florida law firm helping clients navigate the maze of regulatory and political processes. Offices in Tallahassee and statewide. More about Lewis, Longman, and Walker's legislative lobbying and other governmental affairs practices is at llw-law.com. Florida United Businesses Association. FUBA is a statewide trade association representing Florida businesses. FUBA also publishes The Advisor, a pocket-sized guide to the Florida legislature. More at fuba.org. And from the Florida AFL-CIO, representing over 900,000 union members, retirees, and their families, committed to building a better future for all Floridians by promoting healthy communities, economic justice, and dignity in the workplace. Online at flaflcio.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.